Okay, we'll call the meeting to order. This is a meeting that we've been really, on a subject that we've been really interested in terms of how it works and how it works into the legislative process, and how different parts of the legislature regard the sanctity of fiscal notes. So we thought we'd try and understand them before we came to our definitive position on fiscal notes. So we're starting the, we have members of the subcommittee here, but we also have members of the legislature and interested people and so forth. But why don't you call the roll so that people at least know who they are.
Okay, Representative Kahn.
Yes.
Representative Abler.
Here.
Representative Holberg.
Here.
Representative Hoppe.
Here.
Representative Huntley. Representative Rood. Representative Scalzi.
Here.
And Representative Solberg.
Okay. And then there are other people like who are honored to have with us, like Representative Carl Sanders. Interesting. Okay, starting the first item is the introduction to fiscal notes and the overview of fiscal notes. Bill.
And Gary.
Okay.
And Gary.
And Gary. Okay. You guys are.
Yeah.
Good.
Well, Madam Chair, we'll start out with some of the basic information on fiscal notes, and I think included in your packet is a Money Matters from 2007. We're currently working on an update on that. Also, there's an interesting article paying the bill that was found in Governing Magazine in the early, I think, 2001. It's an interesting little article on fiscal notes, and also some statistics. Basically, I found this when I was going through some information from past files, and one of them said that fiscal notes started in 1955, and I should quiz you on the state, but it's Wisconsin. Basically, fiscal notes put a price on proposed legislation, and they're very important in the legislative process. It should be an objective opinion on the change in expenditures and revenues that will result from a bill. Legislators need this information to make informed decisions on their proposed legislation. A fiscal note may influence if a bill passes, if it fails, or if changes need to be made to the bill to adjust the cost of revenue or bring in more revenue or adjust for the cost. In the article that obtained the bill that the Governing Magazine, they talk about an example that happened in Arizona. It's interesting. It says that Arizona, they misestimated the cost of their alternative fuel tax rebate by at least 4,000%. The state estimated the cost between $3 to $10 million, and it turned out to be between $400 and $600 million. In fact, this was on the news, I remember, a couple years ago, too. Now, Minnesota statute, section 3.98, this is the statute that addresses the fiscal note process, and it basically states that the legislation states that the head or chief administrative officer of each department or agency of the state government, and that includes the Supreme Court, shall prepare a fiscal note at the request of the chair of the standing committee to which the bill has been referred, or to the chair of the House Ways and Means Committee. The statute requires fiscal notes to include the following. It has to cite the effect in dollar amounts. You'll see that on the first pages. It has to cite the statutory provision affected. It has to estimate the increase or decrease in revenue or expenditures. And it should include the cost which may be absorbed by the agency or program without additional funds. And I think in your packet you have an example of that, the fiscal note that the Department of Education did on when the name change, where they said that they could absorb, I think it was like $39,000. Other things that it has to include includes the assumptions used in determining the cost estimates. It has to specify any long-term range implications. A lot of times you'll find this in, for example, the area that I cover, corrections, that there may be a bill and it raises the length of time for a sentence, but it may not start. You know, the people are already going to prison for, say, 20 years, and it raises the 20-year term to 30 years, so it has the long-range effects. And the fiscal note may comment on technical or mechanical defects in the bills, but shall not express opinions concerning the merits of the proposal. In addition, I should point out that in addition to the statute, that the manuals that MMB have, the fiscal note also includes full-time equivalents. You'll see that usually on the first page. It'll include a bill description. It'll include expenditure and revenue formulas. In other words, if there's a formula how they got to the maybe the cost, it should include the formula. It should include local government costs, and it should have references and sources. In other words, maybe they did a study in the state of Michigan. Michigan looked there, had a bill very similar. It should include that. And it also has a contact information, which is important. If you have a question on the fiscal note, you have contact information there. It'll have the name of the person responsible and their phone number. It will also have the executive budget officer comments. How to request a fiscal note and when to request a fiscal note. Basically, you know, what we have been doing here through the House is the staff for the Ways and Means Committee can request it, or the fiscal analyst. And I think Mr. Marks has some additional information on this.
Madam Chair, members, just a couple comments here. While the law states that the request has to come from a chair of the standing committee where the bill is, or the chair of the Ways and Means Committee, we've had pretty much a standing policy in the House for at least the 13 years or so I've been chief fiscal analyst, that the fiscal staff are requesting the fiscal note and not checking with chairs all the time to see if they need one or not. And that's it's been an ongoing policy, and it basically puts the decision in the hands of either the fiscal note coordinator or the fiscal staff. And it's we're trying basically to make decisions on, does this bill need a fiscal note or not, and trying to get the requests in. And it's, you know, we typically get requests from through committees or from committee chairs. We also get requests from authors of bills. Hey, I introduced this bill, I need a fiscal note on it. And we try to work within whatever the situation is. Does this bill really need a fiscal note or not? Does it have a fiscal impact? And there are some that don't. Or is the fiscal impact so obvious we don't need a fiscal note? If the bill is taking a $1 million grant program and making a $2 million grant program, you probably don't need a fiscal note unless you want to have the agency or provide the agency with an opportunity to say we're going to have more administrative costs because of that. But in most cases, that's not going to be the situation, and you really don't need a fiscal note on that kind of bill. Bonding bills are another example. We don't request fiscal notes on bonding bills because it's the bonding cost, or the debt service cost, and that's all worked into a bigger formula. And then the other thing which we're going to talk about later is we frequently get requests for fiscal notes on bills that are tax-related bills that we don't do fiscal notes on, we do revenue estimates on, and we will discuss that later as we go through this document.
Okay, Madam Chair, I think the next item we'll cover is informal fiscal notes, and basically I think there's two ways to do that. One is by we will contact an agency, and a good example of that is last year we had the Department of Corrections and Sentencing Guidelines run different scenarios on bed savings. We did that directly with the agency. Now, MMB probably doesn't like that way, but it's a quick way of doing things. They would prefer that if you have an idea that you have draft legislation drawn up, and we as the fiscal analyst, we can send that over to MMB, and they can do, they'll put a X number on it, and that will go through the formal process and with the timelines and everything, and you'll get it back with an informal fiscal note. The next item is checks and balances in the system. Many cases, fiscal notes they're difficult to do because they're projecting into the future. I mean, you know what we have when we have our forecasts here, how, you know, positive or negative they have been. But there are checks and balances in the system, in the current system. First of all, the fiscal note should go to, you know, find, or the MMB will determine what agencies that should see that fiscal note. The agency should give the fiscal note or the proposed the legislation to individuals with expertise in the area. You know, that they have the expertise and they should be working on the fiscal note. From there, it should go to a fiscal note coordinator. Each agency has a fiscal note coordinator. They do a review of the agency bill. This is important. When I worked, I have told this example a couple times. When I was at DHS, when I was working with the fiscal note coordinator, he spotted a couple million-dollar mistake because the individual didn't realize that did the fiscal note that the dollars are in thousands. You know, a simple mistake, you know, relatively new person. The next checks and balance that we have is the executive budget officer. They will review it, and they will make comments. And I don't know if that's in your packet, but Representative Kahn, you had a great example of this, I think, in House File 8 this year, where they... the executive budget officer, I think, did a couple paragraphs on the bill. The next next check is probably the fiscal analyst. It's myself and the other analysts. We will take a look at it. Sometimes we will find maybe a mistake or maybe there's a different way of approaching it, some different assumptions. And I have the example of that is a couple years ago we had three strikes legislation. Very expensive bill. Three strikes means if you have three felonies, you're going to go to prison for a very long time with a set prison sentence. We had the fiscal note done, but we called a couple states that already went through this, California and Washington, and found out that when they did their estimate, it was not as costly as they expected. In fact, we cut that fiscal note down by half. The other check is the author himself or herself. You have a bill, you're going to look at that bill, and you might have some different assumptions, and you can call either the fiscal analyst or the individual, the agency, or MMB on this. We had about three cases last year in public safety where the author called either MMB or the agency. And then lastly, there's outside sources. Another example in my area as public safety is that we had a bill that increased crimes, and the county attorneys felt that this bill was really, that it overstated the cost, that it really would not have the bad impact that was proposed in the fiscal note showed. So they sent information to us, which we gave the sentencing guidelines and corrections, and they also lowered their assumption on that. So the next item that probably this leads into, it's does the legislature have to abide by the numbers that the agency use in the fiscal note? Now, we have been telling members that the legislature is not obligated by either law or rule to use the estimates in a fiscal note. The fiscal note is considered advice to the legislature on what the executive branch thinks are the costs associated with a new program. And a lot of times, you know, when some of these fiscal notes are very detailed, then you're going to have a range. And sometimes they will pick the mid-range, but are there other ranges that could be used? And I think Mr. Marks also has a few comments on this.
Madam Chair, what I was going to add here is that in some cases the cost is obvious. If it's a formula-type program, and if the bill says we're going to pay so many dollars per student, for example, in education, it's a pretty straightforward fiscal note. It's the number of dollars times the number of students involved. Where you get into the issue of what is there discretion in funding the costs or not is often in administrative costs and issues with state agencies. And if a fiscal note says that in order to implement the program described in the bill, the agency has to add 10 staff, there's probably room to work with that. Maybe it would only take 9 staff to do that. Maybe there are other things the agency's doing that they wouldn't have to do. And that's where you get into issues of if the fiscal note says it's going to cost $100,000 to administer this, does the legislature have to appropriate $100,000? No. The legislature could make the choice to tell the agency to do it and only appropriate $50,000. Maybe give suggestions on things the agency's doing now they don't have to do. Maybe in an extreme case the legislature may decide the agency didn't put enough cost in the fiscal note that they need to be doing more to administer the program than they suggested in the fiscal note and maybe appropriate more for it. But the legislature doesn't have to abide by the fiscal note. In some cases it's simply practical. If it's a formula-driven program, there's not a whole lot of room to look at other options there. If it's administrative cost, if it's something where there's a question on it, then there is room to work with it.
Madam Chair, the next area will be the local impact. Basically, the fiscal manual states that any known local government cost should be included in the fiscal note. Now, this is difficult to do at times because a lot of times, I mean, you have to contact the counties or the cities to find out, what's going on there. A lot of times, I mean, I think this is probably one of the weak points in the fiscal note system. But the legislature did try to address that, too, by having local impact notes. And this is in legislation, Minnesota Statutes 3.987-89. And here the chair or the ranking minority member of the tax committee has to request this type of note. And I think there are about 18 exceptions where it does not have to be, where they do not have to do it if it involves a local elections or inflation. But there's a small number of these completed in 09. I think there was only four of them completed, and I believe they're still working on one. 08, there was one completed. 07, four completed. And 06, four completed. And we'll go from there to revenue notes, which Mr. Marks will cover.
Madam Chair, members, revenue estimates are basically the fiscal notes for tax bills. And anything that involves tax revenue is going to be a revenue estimate as opposed to a fiscal note. The revenue estimates go through a different process. They're prepared by the Department of Revenue. They're not reviewed by the Department of Finance. The request goes through the tax committee or the tax chairs, and then it's a process of the Department of Revenue preparing a revenue estimate and then providing that information. Just a note, if you're looking at the Money Matters, the revenue estimates are also available on the web, and there's a web address in there. Gets complicated in a few areas. There are some bills that need both revenue estimates and fiscal notes. And an example might be a program that's establishing a new tax credit, for example. There would be a tax cost to that or a revenue loss associated with that. There may also be an administrative cost for the Department of Revenue to set up that program, and they might have to add staff or add lines to the tax form or create new tax forms or so on to do that. And the revenue estimate will deal with the revenue loss or revenue gain, if that's it, but then there would also be a fiscal note requested to deal with the administrative cost on that. So there are a number of bills that might need both. Just a couple statistics here. In the 2009 session, in 1 year, there were 225 revenue estimates prepared, and that's an unduplicated count. If it was the House file and the Senate file, both had revenue estimates, but they were identical. They're only counted once in that 225 number. For the 2007 and 2008 sessions, or for the 2 years of the biennium, there were 577 unduplicated revenue estimates prepared. So it appears that we're on a lower revenue estimate number for this two-year period than we were for last one. Finally, just one other complicating factor I'd add there is there are some bills that actually where both a revenue estimate and a fiscal note might address the revenue issues there, and those tend to be things that involve the Department of Revenue, but also might involve other agencies. And one I can think of was when we were dealing with issues with gas taxes several years ago. We often ended up with both fiscal notes and revenue estimates estimating the gas tax amount because the Department of Transportation did the gas tax in the fiscal note, Department of Revenue did it in the revenue estimate. That's not a common occurrence. It's an unusual occurrence. But it's basically, though, that items that deal with taxes need a revenue estimate. There are other revenues, fees and so on will... In most cases, fees would actually be addressed in a fiscal note, not a revenue estimate. And I think the key thing to remember is the Department of Revenue is preparing the revenue estimate, so that if it's a revenue source that's going to run through the Department of Revenue, it's probably going to need a revenue estimate rather than a fiscal note.
Madam Chair, the last item that we'll be covering, we have some statistics that we want to go over. We received this from MMB, and they have a lot of statistics on their website and also sent us over some. And what we did is we summarized some of these statistics, and I think you have two pages on that. Basically, you'll see that overall for this for 09, the 09 session, that there were 1,092 fiscal notes requested. This was 11 more than 07, but it was about 200 less than 01. 01 was the big year when they had over 1,300 requests. The low year was 2003. That's when we had one of the budget deficits. It's only 639 fiscal notes requested. Under that chart, there's the percent that are completed. It's in 09, 75% were completed. 15% were made inactive. Inactive means maybe the member pulled the bill, or the bill was not going anywhere, so we decided to make the fiscal note inactive. And 10% were incomplete. Average number of agencies per note, 2.28 agencies per note. And the average number of days for completion were 9 days.
Terry, I might just add one other thing on the inactive. Where that would frequently happen would be where a bill gets, a fiscal note gets requested on the bill in one format, the bill gets amended in a committee before the fiscal note's completed, and so we put a request in for the next version of the bill, and then the previous one would become inactive. So that's also, that 15% seems like a fairly high number, but that it includes previous versions of the same bill.
Then the last chart, members, it's the 09 fiscal notes by agency, but it only includes those agencies with over 100 requests. And you'll see that the Department of Human Services, they're number one with total fiscal notes assigned 298, close to 300. 85% were completed. Average days to completion, 12.4. But here's an interesting point on that. You look at the footnote of the DH fiscal notes. About 71% were requested by the Senate and 29.6% were requested by the House. The second agency, which I was sort of surprised at, is the Education Department, and they're at 226 notes assigned to them in the 09 session. Once again, that you'll see that the Senate, they requested 60% of those notes and 40% were requested by the House. Then the other is just simply goes down from there, DPS, that's the Department of Public Safety at 171, and it ends up with transportation at 105 notes. I'm sure that ends the presentation. We'll stand for questions.
Any questions?
Just a point of conflict that comes up a lot. It was mentioned in the presentation about what does a fiscal note mean and are we bound by it? That would be something that we might want to look at. It seems like we're told we're bound by it, but it's not according to the statute. So.
Well,
otherwise, it becomes a practical question.
Well, one of the questions was we had a big conflict in our committee on a fiscal note that applied to the Attorney General's office. And we decided it didn't make any sense, so we ignored it. But then when we got to conference committee, we had a senator who would say, we cannot do this because of the fiscal note. So, we get to those kinds of conflicts.
I think in the process, both myself and Representative Bishop and Representative Nabok, over the years, we do have a budget resolution, and we have all, I think, both sides stood up in the aisle and said, there's a fiscal note associated with this, and you are, unless you can prove differently, it violates the budget resolution. So even though they are indeed advisory in law, by practicality, I think for both sides of the aisle are very concerned about having a program start or something start that we can just say that the agencies can eat it. Now, in addition to that, though, it's also frustrating on the other side as well. And that is, if you look at that education one that's, I think, in our packet, for 39,000 or something like that. It was changing the name of the Department of Education. it was 39,000, but here the agency, well, it was actually a request from the agency in the governor's office to change the name. And that's when they said, well, they can eat it. Well, if it's a cost, it's a cost. And if it's a need it, maybe then they went to change the name and put up a new sign that they could have need, you know, and made a cut in the state budget or hired another half-time person or something like that to made some choices. Now, we understand that the agencies have some autonomy to make choices, but sometimes this, something, sometimes if the agency wants to do it, they can eat it. If they don't want to do it, they can't eat it. It's a cost. Yeah.
Yes, we did pass out the Attorney General's fiscal note, including the fiscal note from 203-204, which came up with zero, and then the fiscal note from 209-202, which came up with what was the total? 2 million each year. So. Yeah. And it's kind of in, and the EBO's comments, which is the example where we had a very lengthy EBO comment on the fiscal note, essentially saying that they didn't understand it either. So, and the result of that was, the final result of it was that we did incorporate, it was a House position, in fact, which was done. We did incorporate it into the final version of the bill, and we met the fiscal note obligation by transferring dollars that the Attorney General still had in their backlog fund or something like that in, and as of yet, they haven't spent any. You know, one of the arguments was that nothing was going to be spent early anyway. If it did cost money, it was going to cost it later. And so far, the follow-up is that they haven't. We transferred in for fiscal year 2010 and nothing's been spent so far. Who knows who's right? We know we're right.
Can we go back to the comments about with Department of Human Services, the timeliness of getting those fiscal notes?
Well, I think we're going to have people. I noticed that Mr. Showalter came in, I think.
I think that's on the agenda. No, he just presented that. Yeah. He just went over what the average was on the timeline for the fiscal note from the department. You know, when he was going over the statistics about the number that he requested in House and Senate, the average time frame for a department, for a fiscal note from the department. I just didn't quite get that.
Oh, okay.
Let's
say it again.
Okay, on the
hard to see each other.
Yeah, the time period for the average days to complete a fiscal note, that's on the right hand column.
Oh, it's on the handout.
Right, it's on the handout. Okay. You'll see that that the Department of Human Services, the average was about 12.4 days of those that were completed. Now, I should point out that the manual, that the agency uses says that they give them 5 working days, that's on average, to complete a fiscal note. Sometimes we have, when we request fiscal notes, we can request an earlier time period. You know, because if maybe it's going to be in committee tomorrow, so we'll request a 1-day turnaround. But sometimes too, and for the agencies, a lot of these are, especially with DHS, I believe, are involved maybe multiple agencies, or it's a big agency, so it involves a lot of different formulas and.
And actually, I didn't happen to have this handout, and I perked up on that 12.4 days. And maybe the department later can comment about it. But I remember we had a delay in the Finance Committee, the Health and Human Services bill, to the very end. And even at that point, it was touch and go because we weren't able to get the fiscal notes from the department in a timely manner when the bills were going through finance and being prepared for re-referral to Ways and Means. Thank you.
It's not 18 days, that's like months.
Mm-hmm. Okay, is there anyone who...
No,
we're now moving to MMB.
Yes.
tell us what they think of the fiscal note process, and then we'll go on from there.
One ever two high bills.
Madam Chair, members, for the record, my name is Jim Showalter, State Budget Director. With me is Craig Weber, Executive Budget Officer from MMP. Thanks for having us over. It's the fiscal note system and the fiscal process is something that statutorily runs through our department, but it's obviously just something of shared interest and concern, because it is really the information flow so that as decision makers, you've got the best information that can be had, hopefully on a timely basis, hopefully on a correct and perfectly accurate basis, but it's sort of like that healthcare analogy. You want it the right amount at the right time and the right dosage, and I think that's part of what we're all struggling with every year, is how to get that right amount there. I believe you've asked us to testify on what MMB's role in this process is, how we do reviews. Happy to do that, and then any other further questions you might have for us. As you had from Mr. Carter, sort of a good summary of the volume of notes that are going through. And I should just say as introduction, they're all wildly different. Although each one is counted as one by our system, and that's what these data points come from, is the fiscal note tracking system. Some fiscal notes are huge. As Representative Abler would say, some of those human services notes have multiple proposals of varying levels of specificity, and that counts as one. And then on the other hand, another one might be a nursing home moratorium exception. That also counts as one, which is an incredibly simple and perfunctory kind of fiscal note. So they vary all over the place. That being said, Mr. Weber has handed out a fiscal note process chart, which we found in our records. It's like, we don't have a lot of off-the-shelf presentation material on fiscal notes. So Mr. Weber, I will walk through how we treat them within the department.
Well, I did notice with approval that the second thing says that the DOF staff reads.
It is a dated document.
Madam Chair, Craig Weber from MMB. I'm going to walk through just basically the fiscal analysts here have already explained how the process works from the legislative standpoint. I will describe it from MMB's standpoint. After we get a fiscal note request from a individual fiscal analyst, it comes into the fiscal note system. MMB staff then looks at the bill, reads it over, kind of decides which agencies need to be included in the fiscal note for this particular bill based on the language that's in there. From time to time, that initial cut can be the agencies who end up on the final version of the note. It can be different as EBOs get to see the bill themselves and kind of say, oh, this provision I think actually affects my agency because of the way it's written. And so the composition of who's actually on a fiscal note can change over from when it's initially received and assigned, but that's the basic process of how it comes into the agency. We assign the agencies, then it goes out to the agencies, they refer it to their programmatic staff and their own budgetary staff to complete the fiscal note, complete all the assumptions, all the kind of perfunctory formula changes or who's impacted, to sign the whole kind of impact of what's going on in the legislation. They complete the note, they sign off on it, and it comes back to us, where individual EBOs then review what the agencies have provided, you know, check it for accuracy, check it for content, make sure the assumptions are all kind of grounded in reality, and it conforms with kind of what we think the intent of the author is. And assuming that we all agree, we go ahead and sign off on the note. And for larger bills, that can mean multiple agencies being involved. I know from my own experience, healthcare reform bills have had 7 or 8 different agencies on them, and we have to go through that process for each individual agency before the fiscal note's then completed. But we get through all that, everybody signs off, and then you've got your completed fiscal note. That is what then is sent to the legislature for their review. And depending on the complexity, depending on the nature of the note, that can either be a fairly brief process or it can take a long, long time. Aligning assumptions between agencies, making sure everyone's on the same page. These can be challenging at times, and it can be fairly necessarily can be, sometimes it can be a slam dunk. So it's hard to kind of put a gauge on you know the complexity of the process because it can vary so much from agency to agency. But that's kind of generally how we go about the fiscal note process internally. And if you have further questions on that, I'd be happy to elaborate.
I just back to my first question. I just remember 11 years, you've seen a lot of fights and have been on a bunch of finance committees. Is there a time when a governor, pick one, has signed a bill where the legislature said the fiscal note wasn't correct and they balanced their budget based upon that note and the governor then ignored his agency?
Is there, I'm going to just make sure I got the question right, Madam Chair or Representative. Is there an instance where a fiscal note was offered was still accurate?
Well,
or I'm not sure where was which part is not. Was it ignoring a fiscal note, or was it that the fiscal note was wrong and something else was inactive?
Well, no. The just Madam Chair, the a time when the MMB, the whatever entity it would have been then, would have said, no, it's going to cost so many dollars. And the legislature says, no, we're not going to accept that. And here's the bill. And the budget's all balanced based upon our use of a smaller number. And have they done that? Has that, have they been, is there a time when that's been done?
Absolutely. I think the fiscal note provides the information of the estimated cost based upon an interpretation of that bill. Now, there's going to be instances, particularly on like operating costs, administrative costs, where there's some discretion there. That this is sort of the agency's best estimate. But the finance chairs, the legislature in general, may have a different opinion. That's the most common instance where some cost may be showing up in a fiscal note. That's an estimated cost for a level of service. And the legislature decides, no, that's not the level of service. That's not what we anticipate doing. That goes through the bill process, is enacted into law. And I think all the fiscal analysts probably could come up with very specific examples of that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two issues. One, what policies or procedures are in place to mitigate or diminish conflicts of interest? In other words, if there is a fiscal note that's going to privatize the Department of Health and everybody that's working on the fiscal note as a result of it is going to lose their job, you know, how do you mitigate those types of conflicts? Because historically, from what I've seen, it costs a whole lot of money to reform anything around here, and many of us have raised our eyebrows around that whole issue. And then the second point is, to the degree that these fiscal notes have to reflect private sector interaction, again, a lot of time around reforms or privatizing things, how do you go about delineating the numbers or costs for services outside of state government in the private sector?
Madam Chair, Representative, good questions. I go back to the somewhat old but still applicable fiscal note process. And you see down here where it gets to executive budget officer reviews fiscal note, and about two-thirds of the way through the document, there's a loop back that occasionally occurs to try and at least handle some of that conflict of interest to have. I think that's why MMB is there. We don't really literally do hardly any for the fiscal notes. We're there to review, make sure there's some consistency, make sure there's some reasonableness to them. And to the extent, probably more than you imagine, there are discussions between the executive budget officer and the agency saying, you know, this assumption doesn't make sense. And it's not an expert review, but it is a knowledgeable person with some inquiry and some understanding of that area to say, you know, this just doesn't make sense. Let's go through this again. Why would privatizing the Department of Health have that impact? The other loop that's not on this chart is then from the fiscal, from the EBO going to the fiscal analyst. Again, probably outside of most legislators' view, are discussions between the EBO and the fiscal analyst, where on some fiscal notes, they're going to say, you know, again, this doesn't strike me as being a reasonable estimate. And so there are also times where that concern will be run back to the state agency, we run back to the EBO, and we might take our approval off of it, we might do another version of it. Things like that do happen. So that's sort of the
the checks and balances of the information you get. The second part about private sector impact, that's just a harder one to estimate, to be honest. If I'm understanding the question right, it's like, how do you think about whether it's a privatization or other kinds of activities that might be done by others, and what would it cost? You know, I think that goes through the fiscal note process, but I would just suggest that we're oftentimes not expert in how what those prices are going to be, and so it's usually a more protracted discussion about what exactly are we trying to privatize, what are the assumptions, and can we bring in somebody from the private sector to talk about those things.
So if I might, just for clarification, you don't have a formal process for seeking out costs of services or goods in the private sector to feed into your fiscal notes, is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative, no. There's no benchmarking to say this is the private sector cost for such and such. There is some guidance that we provide for, so what we know or expect are some standards for safe costs, but we're not giving the private versus public delivery option on every fiscal note.
And if I might, just one more question. To what degree do you consult with other states across the country that may or may not have enacted similar? We heard the story about the three strikes and using California and Washington's experience ahead of our policy change to impact what the assumptions were on a fiscal note. Do you have a national organization that kind of tracks this stuff, or how do you factor that information into your process?
Madam Chair, Representative, I would say that gets factored in only in the most unusual circumstances because of the volume of fiscal notes that are going through, the volume of context that, and each of these are very specific. The devil is always in the details of what are the agencies, the state laws that apply to the proposed change. And so while we have a National Association of State Budget Officers, there's not a sharing of fiscal notes per se, because they're all, there's a lot of them. We all have different processes, different assumptions, and different contexts and environments. That being said, once in a while it does. Once in a while, especially when it's really big legislation, where we're following the footsteps of some other state, we'll try to find that information or talk with the fiscal analyst to make sure we're all looking at it in a similar context. But I think it's more the exception than the rule.
And Madam Chair, I'm sorry, but I just have one other really quick question. For the average person that's in an agency working really busily on fiscal notes during the legislative session, what are they doing in the downtime, and how, in general, is that experience supporting their, what do these people do the other 6-8 months of the year?
Madam Chair, Representative,
I'll take a quick shot of it.
Craig has anything to add, but I think you'll probably hear from other people if you want on some of the other things that are going on. In many agencies, the largest of agencies, you've got people who are doing reports and forecasts and doing sort of monthly monitoring of what's going on. If you think about some of the cash flow discussions we've started to have publicly, that's really monitoring what's going on, not just prospectively. It's really what happened last week, last month. Sometimes these are the same people who are doing that kind of work. In other instances, there are accounting or financial people who are putting appropriations into place, working through accounting transactions or other kinds of monthly activities and control activities. In some instances, there are also program staff who are really close to the program and are implementing the law. They're just tapped during the legislative session for their expert advice on what this potential tweak would be. It maybe is run through a central fiscal person, but it's that programmatic delivery that's their 12-month year done. So it depends on the context, but is that a fair grouping? It depends on which agency you're talking about, how that would be divided up.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
A couple of things. This is not with the fiscal notes, but I wonder if when we talk about the impact on private sector, maybe this is not formalized, but in a political standpoint, we hear often about the revenue estimate, if that happens. And I don't know as if that's formalized in a revenue estimate. Maybe somebody from the Cynthia or others would able to answer that if we have a formal way of being able to have a revenue estimate, say, well, this is what the private sector costs are. I mean, if we raise the sales tax, there's some costs associated with the private sector reprogramming. So I think we're not immune to the private sector or saying that we never look at that.
Madam Chair, if I could also add, you know, what we try to report on is the direct budget impact, mm-hmm. state budget impact. That doesn't necessarily mean at all that, you know, there's not other impacts or other impacts on other entities. They may not be immediate, or they may not directly impact the state budget. That's where you get into some of the local impact notes and other things like that, where there's some other entities that are involved. May or may not have a state, show up in a state general fund or some other fund.
Madam Chair, just a comment on that. I think there are private sector impacts, if you want to call it that, that are taken into account. And I can think of cigarette tax increase as an example. The more the cigarette tax is increased, there's an assumption of less usage. You don't get as many. You wouldn't get as many dollars in. And I would assume the same thing happens in some of the other various DHS programs or other areas. You look at as you look at income levels and so on, but I think it's a to bring in the direct private sector impact is a much more difficult assumption to build in. It's to the extent it affects the money, and it's something that can be identified. I think that's done.
Well, one of the interesting things is how far you look at the multiplication or the back checking of impacts. Let's get to the cigarette when we had the banning cigarette smoking in bars and restaurants and so forth. And we had this big complaint of a lot of fiscal impact from those places. I don't know, I guess the place where we really saw it a little bit was in charitable gambling. It actually did go down. But one of the things that there was evidence of in it's kind of interesting evidence because you usually don't get this kind of before and after. But I think it was in Boise, Montana that had banned cigarette smoking for about 6 months, and the city had done it, and then the legislature told them that they couldn't do it, but you had the 6 month period, and the admissions for heart attacks in the hospital, stroke or something, you know, adverse coronary things went way down in that 6 month period, and then went way up again. That's probably my editorial. Went down, and then went discernibly up, which was a very, you know, usually you don't get to do those kind of neat experiments like
Madam
that.
Chair,
but the
6 months is in the summertime. Part of the summer.
I don't remember what the timing was, but anyway, that was, so that's one of the things is that we don't, sometimes it might be interesting to look at the future effects on, like some of the things that we're talking about, you know, the fact that we never look at fiscal impacts over the, hardly ever, at least beyond the biennium or maybe the 4 years and so forth, and the estimate that as creditable people as the Federal Reserve System have done on the cost effectiveness and business community cost effectiveness of early childhood education, and the question of how we can look at those kinds of fiscal impacts, which aren't a legislator imagining them, but very credible financial experts saying that they exist, or things that you can see because another state has done them, and then you can see what the effect it was. Some of the tax credit things that a couple of us have wanted to look at, that the tax chair, I guess there's a revenue that the tax chair is correct in the House at least is terrifically opposed to, so we never get to look at them. But you can look at another state that's done it and then come up with credible data about that there is, if you go out maybe more than the biennium, you get a very positive fiscal effect. So I don't know. You know, we continually say we don't do enough long-range planning. I don't know how we can work this into this. Actually, I have a slightly different question, which is, I don't know if this is something that we thought of very much, but but apparently Minnesota is one of the few states that has the executive agency do this. And should the legislature take over doing this in a sense analogous to the Congressional Budget Office? Isn't that sort of a job of the Congressional Budget Office in Washington?
Had close friendships with people at CBO.
Okay.
And you know that you're right, that they would do the fiscal notes on the federal level. OMB typically would end up having two scores, so that we would also look at the bills. At OMB, CBO would do the same thing. You have somewhat dueling information, but
Is that something that anyone's talked about doing here?
Madam Chair, really, that's the discretion of the legislature. I think we're trying to execute and get you the information you want. And within all of the constraints of time and resources and volume going through and all that kind of stuff, but it's just been a long-standing practice. And I guess I wouldn't be too close to that.
Madam Chair, that's been around for a long time for us to consider that. And I just want to ask a practical question for that as we consider that two things. Let's just take the one agency, Health and Human Services. If we were to do that, how many employees would we need?
In the legislative process.
Well,
it's not an easy way you get them.
Well, I understand where we get them from. I just want to know, I mean, we could cut their budget down and transfer them here. But how many employees, and that's the big agency, I think. You know, that's kind of the agency that has prompted this subcommittee meeting, is the difficulties we had in getting information in a timely fashion. And also some statements that were made probably not correctly, but while we're not going to do fiscal notes on things that are not going to go through the legislature, and that's frustrating. So how many people are involved in this, roughly?
I'm looking back to Jane.
Okay. Well, come up to this. Come up.
Madam Chair, I'm Representative Goldberg. I'm Jane Rankin. I'm the Budget Director at the Department of Human Services. We do not have a fiscal analysis, a fiscal note unit in the agency. We use the model that Jim Showalter referred to, which is that it's primarily program people who are on the ground running MA, running Minnesota Care, running a particular waiver program in the healthcare area. And during the legislative session, they are tapped by a small group of legislative liaisons to provide the expert information that goes into developing a fiscal note.
Well, what
another major area that we use for our entitlement programs is the Reports and Forecast Division, and I'm sure you're familiar with Mr. George Hoffman. He's got a group of four economists that work for him and a few other staff.
I'm sure one of the frustrations, I think, from the legislative process, and I've heard in all my years I've been here, and no matter who's in control, is the difficult to get the information from the legislative process. And so if we had a legislative budget office, I mean, I'll just call it that, that would have to necessitate for them to do their job all the information that is now deemed, no, you can't have it until we announce the budget or our particular program. From the executive branch, and I don't care who the governor is, it's always been that way. The timingness of getting information so that hopefully we can make good decisions, and it's being controlled by the executive branch. And I think it's frustrating for the minority members in the legislature as it is for the majority members, because you want to be able to have information flowing, and it's in effect embargoed until a certain date. And sometimes that doesn't provide. So if we established a legislative office, then I would think that in order for them to function, they would have to have some of that responsibility as well, or at least there has to be a sharing of that information.
Madam Chair, Representative, I believe, you know, to that point, it would be useful just to think about the level of detail that you're asking for, because, you know, from a central budget standpoint, I think we could, you know, well, we do create forecasts of revenue. And even if we hadn't farm out the reports and the spending forecast for education and human services, you know, it's not at an aggregate level. It's within the realm of a few analysts to try and figure out some rough nature of where things are going. The further down into specific programs, the program changes that you want information, you know, just by that very nature, the more information you need on what's happening at any given point in time, the more analysis is necessary because of the interactions. And what you see is, and particularly in human services, is just the multiplication of all of that. Whereas, you know, one analyst can pretty much run education because of the formula. It's, you know, a set of formulas that goes out. Nothing like that exists in the way our we structure our healthcare and human services programs. There are just a lot of interrelationships. So it's not to answer the number, but it's just, I think, for everyone's consideration, that's the trade-offs that you get into the more you try to ask what's a specific proposal going to do.
Oh, thanks. It looks like we're on point number four, recent experiences here. Is that right, Madam Chair? Do you want questions about stuff now? Is this a good time
to
do dialogue? Okay, well, since Ms. Rankin is there, I was just reading, it's interesting, the statistics, that there's actually a fewer less than there was in 2001 and about an average number the last three cycles, which is interesting. So I thought there was way more, and I guess it's the Senate coming up the process from what I can tell. So that's good news for the House side again. Ms. Rankin, can you comment about like 12 days? I mean, some of your notes are really complex.
No, those numbers are really incredible.
It's yeah, so
half the number of senators.
Yeah. Well, they're busy over there. We always thought they were better than us, Madam Chair. They thought they were, you know. But anyway, so it takes the 12 days. Is that the same? How has that changed over the years? Is that, do you have an idea?
Chairman, Representative Abler, I actually can't answer the question about how it's changed over the years because I've been at DHS for a little over a year now. And I did have a former life in the human services area, but it was not at the agency side of things. What I can say is one thing that I've noticed since I've been at DHS, and it's a change from what I remember happening when I was on the legislative staff side, is the timing of when a proposal is brought up in committee, introduced for a hearing. There is now, I would say, much more compression between what happens in the policy committee and what happens in the finance committee. I remember that a bill used to get introduced and it would be referred to a policy committee and it would have a hearing and amendments would be offered and discussion would occur and it would become clear what the author's intent was for the legislation. And agency staff, the legislative side of DHS, would be in that hearing, listening, taking notes, because it becomes very important to understand what the intent is of a bill in order to do a good fiscal note analysis. And then as amendments would get offered, points would be raised, clarifications would be given, amendments would be made, and slowly the proposal would shape up and get pinned down, and from a DHS viewpoint, I would say it would become more fine-tuned and able then to understand. We would understand how we were to implement it. We would understand, can we do this under current federal law, or are we going to have to go back to the federal agency and request either a state plan amendment, which takes a little bit of time and is kind of more guaranteed typically, or are we going to have to get a waiver approval, which takes a longer amount of time and is not as guaranteed? All those sorts of elements would become clear, and that's all the underlying information that go into doing a fiscal note analysis, at least for something that is impacting one of the health care programs or one of the other entitlement programs at DHS. And what I see now recently in the past 5 years or so, there's not always that time for discussion and clarification in policy committee. It either happens in finance committee in a rushed fashion, or sometimes it doesn't really happen in a public hearing, and it's not until the chairman's mark comes out, the committee bill comes out with all the pieces in it, that the agency then can see and understand, oh, this was the intent of the proposal that someone mentioned in committee. So that's one of the changes that I can say has made doing timely fiscal notes much more challenging. It's just there's not automatic time built into the process for the proposal to get clarified to a point where it can be fiscal noted.
Somebody has a cell phone turned on that's giving us feedback, so would people please turn off their cell phones if they got one?
Madam Chair, and I have way more questions. I'll just limit it to, I'll just ask for some homework, and then I have a suggestion. Since this is a new part for you, could you, like, somebody must know these numbers. Could you go back and ask people? We think there's a problem, and so if it's always been 12.4 days, then we'll know we just think it's raining more often. But I think it would just be interesting to see the trend. If there's been some layoffs and some short staff, which is what I've understood. Or if it's just that's how it's always been and we just think it's different, that would be productive over the last couple of years. And I have a suggestion, Madam Chair, which is my one idea I brought to this subcommittee that might make it better, at least in our world. Some of the ideas, as a person who has written a couple of bills and tried to get a few fiscal notes, some things are just great ideas, but they cost like way too much. And once you realize that they're going to cost like a lot of money, it's all done now. And the fiscal note still has to be done to the same detail as one that's actually going to go forward. And if there's some way that we could request like a ballpark fiscal note, and they would say, Jim, that's way too much, so all rats, you know. And then you wouldn't have to go through all of the troubles. But there's somewhere really going to go. Like the chairman's got a proposal. It's going to be their something marquee bill. You know it's going to get off the House floor and maybe get to conference. That those have to be done with thoroughness, because that's going to be affecting the budget target. Is there somewhere to go with? I should be asking MMB about that.
Going back to the forecast, there was one thing that we always used to say at our fiscal notes, was that it always told you whether the department whether wanted to do it or not.
Right.
And there's one which was actually written out, and I wish I had, you know, I think I was so mad I just threw it. But it was adding some women's rights activity to the Human Rights Department, and it came back that it was going to cost untoward millions.
Well, that was the number.
And that was literally written out, you know. And the and so that would have been perfect to have kept for this. I may still have it somewhere. I can't easily find it.
Well, Madam Chair, can I just follow up? As you look at this, and here's from the Department of Human Services, a memo dated February 2nd, and it's to the chairs of the committee, and I don't know if you have a copy of that or not, but it's, you know, you're going to prioritize how the agency does the fiscal notes, and formal fiscal notes on schedule in fiscal committees. And I don't think Representative Aber has got a bad suggestion, because one of the reasons this was prompted is legislators tried to deal with the problem of the GAMC cut and non-allotment. They said, well, what are these proposals going to cost? Here's another proposal. What's it going to cost? And the department said, well, we're not going to do anything until the bill is introduced. Well, that doesn't help the legislative process to be able to think through this. Additionally, in step three, the informal fiscal note request by chairs of jurisdiction, as we try to set our targets, we want to do them in a hopefully somewhat half intelligent way anyway. and you need the information. And so as a chair of a department, can say, well, you know, if I do this, what is it? What are we going to save? How much is it going to cost? And with the department say, well, that's the third. I got to do all these other bills that are introduced first. And I know that there's interchange between the departments and the fiscal analysts, but it seems to me that we have to get to the point where we develop some trust and some also, I think, some informal ways to be able to have that communication back and forth, to be able to take a decision or a suggestion that a legislator has and be able to say this is a good idea or not a bad idea. And you know, we all, whether you're minority or majority, we have election certificates. And if I want to have an idea, I should be able to ask the executive board or executive agency what they're going to cost. And if it costs too much and there's a justification, I drop it. You don't have to introduce a bill for it. And I think that I've served in both majority and minority, and I think that's more of a protection for some of the minority members and for the majority members who have some of the fiscal staff at their. So I think Representative Weaver doesn't have a bad suggestion to try to look at ways we can work this out. Maybe it has to be a little bit more informally with the fiscal staff, but legislation needs to be involved in it.
Madam Chair and Representative Solberg and Representative Abler, I'd like to respond to several of your comments. First of all, this memo that I'm well aware of, the memo, I wrote it. I was advised that this was something that hadn't been done at my agency in the past. And, you know, I think I was on the job 2 months or so before I wrote this memo. It was trying to communicate to legislators, in particular to the chairs, the committees that DHS works most closely with, that we were intending to provide the legislature with information that they were asking about, but because of workload demands, we were trying to manage the workload. I have to say, you will never see a memo like this under my signature again. And I've made that clear to people back at my agency. I think it caused a lot more heartache and frustration than it was worth. I'm aware of the comments that you're referring to about the GAMC work that's been going on over the interim, and I would say again that it was kind of a misunderstanding or an interpretation of some shorthand language that we used back in the department to differentiate between what we call internally technical assistance when a legislator or legislative staff calls and they're asking a general question about, gee, what's the population like on GAMC program? How many of those folks have a mental illness diagnosis? Or how much money have we spent in the last year providing dental care to someone on MA? When it's simply collecting information and sending it back out to the legislators, we call that technical assistance. We also call technical assistance doing some of what Representative Abler was mentioning, where a legislator has an idea and they want a ballpark estimate of, gee, what might it cost if we expanded MA to include this kind of service? One of the difficulties, honestly, though, we have at the department is we need to be very careful because there's a line that is not clear, but yet we recognize is there, where something that we give out as an estimate of a cost or impact, then that becomes what shows up on a legislative tracking sheet as the cost of the proposal. And I think at DHS in particular, because we have so many entitlement programs,
which, as you all know, the funding for that is basically on automatic pilot in a lot of ways. If we end up assigning a cost to a feature of one of the entitlement programs and we haven't carefully estimated it and done a professional job of understanding the implications so that we're overestimating it, that is tying up general fund resources that aren't available for other areas of state government and state activities. And so we understand very well that an entitlement program, you've set it up to be funded at just the level that it needs to do what it's supposed to do and no more. And that's a consideration that weighs very heavily on the fiscal notes that we do. And that's one of the major concerns I have about trying to be responsive to legislators and give the technical assistance and the informal estimates that you're asking for so that you can do your policy development work, and yet being careful not to get to a point where we've given something that gets interpreted as a fiscal note number, which then it shows up in a budget proposal when we haven't actually gone through, and in the MA area in particular, it's an iterative process where we're checking with the policy people about, gee, what do you think this bill means? How would we implement it? What kind of cost might we have communicating it to the counties? Do we have to change the computer systems that the counties are using? There's a whole litany of things that are program folks mostly are looking at, and that all goes into building a fiscal note analysis. And as Representative Abler knows, sometimes the narrative that goes along with a DHS fiscal note is quite lengthy because we're laying out all those assumptions so that you can see what underlies the number. But bottom line is we at the agency are trying to be as responsive as we can to legislative requests and to legislative proposals. And it's a challenge for us. It's not at some times of the year, if our reports and forecast folks are busy getting ready to do the November forecast or the February forecast, they are also key players in any fiscal note analysis of an MA or other entitlement proposal. And I know because Mr. Hoffman's office is right next to mine, and I see the steady stream of people that go over to his office to have a conversation about something that they're working on to do either the forecast or a fiscal note. So then when you factor in the governor's budget development, it's a juggling act for us. And sometimes we're successful and sometimes we're not. DHS is such a large agency. Some areas of our agency, it can be pretty quick to do a fiscal note analysis. Other areas, not so much. And I guess the other thing that I would just comment about the fiscal note statistics is thinking about the DHS experience over the last year. There have been, I would say, a fair number of those Senate fiscal note requests, probably, where the request gets into the system, so it's officially a fiscal note request, but it's not clear to someone, so we have a conversation with the staff or the member and get them the information they want, and they kind of abandon the fiscal note, but it doesn't get closed out in the system. So that's just a caution that I would say to all of you, is that the statistics of time to completion aren't necessarily always accurate. I know they're the best you have, but just because something hasn't been signed off to completion, it doesn't mean that the agency hasn't responded to the legislative interest and given the information that you're looking for.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Ms. Rankin and I have a follow-up question on a different issue with Mr. Showalter, but Going back to the memo, and I understand you've withdrawn the memo, but somebody still needs to be the gatekeeper, and that's you. And my concern when I did read the memo, or my concern with the role of the gatekeeper, would be the sensitivity to where we are in the legislative session. For example, Representative Solberg referenced the House budget resolution. You know, so for example, you did have on the memo number 3, informal fiscal analysis requested by chairs or fiscal committees and so forth. Well, at the beginning of the session, the Ways and Means Committee, chaired by Representative Solberg, is pretty busy setting targets. And I think one of the problems was the feeling that this was sort of an absolute list. Well, hopefully, at the beginning of the session, when you would get informal requests that would help the legislature set targets, in your case, Department of Human Services, although there has to be a gatekeeper in every agency, would be sensitive to what's going on during the legislative session. We have rather strict timelines with this committee, the full committee, in terms of setting those targets. And we need that information before we pass the House budget resolution. So I guess I like your comment in terms of the sensitivity of that. And you heard my comments probably earlier when we were having difficulty meeting. Again, under the House rule, the timelines for getting the bills out of finance, over to Ways and Means, and ultimately on the House floor. We had deadlines we had to meet, and quite frankly, we had a lot of frustration with the Department of Health and Human Services bill being getting the information necessary so we could move the bill forward and be within the targets as the bill left finance and would be reviewed in Ways and Means to make sure that the bill was in target, within the target. So again, that whole sensitivity to legislative timelines is what I'm asking about and need some assurance from you and the other agencies as well that's part of your mindset, you know, as the gatekeeper.
Madam Chair and Representative Carlson, I would say thank you for bringing up the point about the House setting their budget targets, because I think that that's honestly something that I was not thinking about last session when I was heavy into learning my new job at Human Services and focused my agency. I would say I tend to think primarily about the chairs that we respond to regularly. And so that's a good reminder to me that there is another need for at a more global House level for some of the information. So I will make a note of that and try to do better about watching for that sort of request and being aware of that pressure this coming session and into the future.
Yeah, and as I point out, Madam Chair, it's not just you I'm directing that to, but others as well, that we have those timelines that we have to meet. If I might, Madam Chair, I did have a question of Mr. Showalter, and there's been a couple of references to GAMC, and you indicated that your role with the department or the department's role is primarily what the impact is on the state budget, and then there was some reference to local units of government. But with GAMC, that's a good example of where there has to be some sharing of information relative to what was brought up earlier about the private sector. I think the question on the private sector at that point probably was, could they deliver a service at lower cost? But there are other ways of measuring the impact on the private sector. You know, for example, indigent care. And when they arrive at a private hospital or a public hospital, under the law, they have to be cared for. Well, if you're looking only at the impact on the state budget, that then is ignoring what the cost would be to a public or private hospital, and then going one step forward or further, ignoring the impact on private insurance. Nationally, there's been a lot of publicity because of the healthcare debate, but they're saying that indigent care is something like $1,000 per health policy as a result of making up for those losses in the various hospitals. So the question is, do you look beyond state budget? And if you don't, should you not be looking beyond the impact of the state budget, because it's going to be paid for one way or another? And GAMC is probably the best example of that.
Chair Carlson, a fine question. And, of course, my comment was really referring to the document, which is a fiscal note, and there's this box in the front. And sometimes we get almost fixated on the box. What does that box represent? What are the numbers in there? And really, it's geared to provide you with the direct fiscal impact on the state budget for a given proposal. That doesn't mean that that's the only analysis and considerations that should be made for public policy. That's just the direct state budget impact, and that's what I was referring to. On an issue like GAMC or many of other proposals, there are a multitude of factors that need to be weighed, and that's what makes the legislative process so difficult, is that there are many, many different elements of information, factors to be weighed, to bring it all into bear. And that's ultimately what, you know, the governor's budget proposal tries to do. That's ultimately what the legislative budget proposals try to do, and ultimately that's, you know, what those competing priorities I have to bring in. It's beyond, above and beyond what the fiscal note says.
Yeah, and I guess my point, Madam Chair, is that we can't be always solely fixed on that box. Or rather,
I'm sorry.
I have a question.
President Scalzi. Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the governor's budgeting process, and this pertains to DHS, I know there was one article in there last year that was a cut in a program. Unfortunately, at the bottom, for the going ahead in the future, there was a requirement for one extra FTE. And I asked at the committee hearing, if we're cutting a program, why do we need an extra FTE? And I think his name was Mr. Coleman, who was there, and he said, somebody has to notify the county, somebody has to work this through the process. And maybe it was computer time, I don't know what it was. But it appeared to me that this was a cost that would be a short-term cost. If we have to notify the counties and work with the different departments to make this cut, it would make some sense that it would be a short-term FTE. And I asked Mr. Coleman at the time, why would this go on? And his answer to me was, and I took notes, was these programs never seem to go away. So right away I thought, and I did send a memo to the governor about that, because I thought it was so unusual that he would have said that. And I'm a little worried about government, you know, increasing the size of government when we're trying to cut a program, because I tended to agree with the cut. But do you ever, when you do a fiscal note, do you ever plan on a short-term cost versus a long-term cost that we can maybe depend on short-term costs going away?
Madam Chair, Representative Scalzi, yes, most definitely. And so as you were talking, I was trying to recollect what particular budget proposal you recall, and I'll have to go back and look because it's not ringing a bell with me. But that's a standard part of fiscal note analysis at DHS, and I would assume it at every other agency, is identifying what is a short-term cost. Sometimes if you're getting off the ground with something new, you need extra resources because you need to do research or you need to set it up. But once you do all that work, you can plug it into your existing staff and your existing program, and there's an ability, especially if it's a modification of something that you have staff in place that are working on anyway, they can just pick up this new activity if it's an ongoing activity, and there would be no additional cost to the agency to do that. So that would be one way that a fiscal note would show a cost in perhaps the first year or so, and then no cost in the out years. As I said, I as you were telling your story, I was trying to figure out if I knew which budget proposal you were thinking of from last session, and it's not ringing a bell with me, so I can go back and look. But
But it is absolutely not the case that we are assuming that it's always going to be a long-term change when there's a new proposal. I mean, we try to recognize when it will cause something that will be, when it's something that it's a new requirement that will need to be continued into the future with more staff costs. We're trying to lay out both sides of that question for your information and understanding so you can make the decision that you need to make about that. I think Bill has some comments.
Madam Chair, Representative Scalzi, that's also a case then if the legislature intended it to be a short-term, a one-year or two-year expenditure where the appropriation ought to reflect that, or the language setting the base budget for the next biennium ought to say the base budget's lower by $50,000 in fiscal 12 or something like that if the intention is that it's a short-term expenditure. So we ought to catch that on and have it tracked on the spreadsheets and language in the bill on it as well.
Yes, and I agree with that, and I apologize. I do not know exactly which one it was. It was a waivered program, but it was an ongoing cost. This FTE was not just a short term. It was forever. And I guess my concern is that as we look, and I've had the same concern with other fiscal note processes, as we look to the future, we're cutting some of these departments, and I'm sure they don't like it. And so as we look to how we're working with these processes, we don't want to be adding employees, and we should be very conscious of that creep as we're working on these processes.
Well, a question I'd like to put on top of that is kind of what kind of looking back analysis do we ever do? Do we ever look at what the fiscal notes were and what the actual cost was? And has anyone ever suggested doing that?
Madam Chair, I think as long as I've been around this business, we've talked about that and occasionally dabble in it. But I'm not aware, Bill, do you know, in any systematic process for assessing how accurate the fiscal notes were? In part because it's extraordinarily difficult, particularly on some of the big ones where they're integrated into the programs and kind of change. How the eligibility change might have marginally impacted medical assistance or something like that. That, you know, is a...
Is this something we should assign to the legislative auditor to do?
Sure.
are they the only people who's not in the room? teach them to ignore these meetings.
Truly, Madam Chair, once in a while there are changes. Okay. That we can, that it's just sort of... Clearly, a standalone program or standalone program change. Oftentimes on the revenue side, where you got a pretty clear indication of what the change is, but you know, there isn't a systematic process that I know of. I think Georgia and Hoffman at DHS occasionally tries to take a look at some of those things in the forecasts, but generally, no. I think you've got that. Not that it isn't valuable.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have to excuse myself in a minute because I'm double booked. But I wanted to I'm glad that Representative Solberry picked up on my thought there. And reading some of the memos and stuff here, maybe as, I don't know if we're meeting a few more times or whatever, but it seems like there's somewhere to...
Let me just say you want that to make now while you're asking, please. We're looking at possibly another meeting in the last week in January.
All right.
27th, 28th, or 29th.
All right.
It's going to, I don't know if the session's going to have lots of time to do extra stuff or no time to do extra stuff or whatever is going to happen.
I think a lot of people wonder that too, Madam Chair. So, but anyway, so maybe there's somewhere to go with this formal-informal thing and as the terms that already seem to exist. And, you know, and maybe even informal wouldn't require a bill to be introduced by its language. But even some bills could be asked for an informal thing. And then the department would know that it's not binding, it's just a ballpark, and we're not going to put it in tracking sheet except mm-hmm. as an estimate pending the real one. And it seems like, and I didn't ask how many of the bills you've written notes on actually become law, but that way at least to get rid of who's going to get to do the chance to do most of these. And some of the Senate notes, and I know Senator Bergman, she'd like just a ballpark just to see if it's something. And, you know, and I know I'd like to know if it's, like, really pricey, if it saves a little money, and... Because sometimes we do a lot of work on a bill, just as much as you guys do. We think, this is a bill. This is going to save real money. We come back and it like costs $10,000. And so it's just as frustrating both ways. And so at least that way we know how to at least abort the process or redo it or something. But maybe we can pursue that a little bit as a, that could be at least be maybe one outcome of our group that we can encourage informal, which takes the pressure off you, I think, and then you're not so liable and you can put one tenth of the time into it. So that's my idea.
No. Madam Chair and members, just one thing to think about on this, and I guess it's a process kind of issue. Right now we have lots of that kind of interaction between fiscal staff and members and so on with agency staff. An issue that has come up here several times is that on the formal fiscal note process, it's the agency and then it's MMB signing off on it, so it's review within another agency, and then it comes to the legislature. The informal kind of discussion is much more agency to fiscal staff, agency to legislator, and so on. And we also end up, particularly with DHS, near the time that bills are getting put together, where DHS is doing estimates that come directly to the legislature and basically bypass MMB. I think one of the questions you need to think about here is that role of the executive budget officer and the role of MMB in this, and how valuable or how important is that and how essential is it? And to what extent is that providing another look, another view at something that may be helpful or maybe doesn't matter to the process? But it's one other thing I think to consider in this. If there's some sort of informal process that's more formally established, should there be a role for MMB in that or not?
Madam Chair, I think this is a great discussion to have, maybe it gives us something to take out of here, because right now they all get requests for fiscal notes, if it's a whimsy thing or if it's like the chairman's marquee bill. And so, because that's what the staff tells us, oh, you need a fiscal note. Oh, okay, we'll request one then, and I'll fill out the form. So that's just, so I think this is a good dialogue.
Now, Madam Chair, I guess my question is either of Gary Carger or Ms. Rankin. On those statistics about the number of fiscal notes, are those numbers duplicative? Reason I ask that, as we all know, a lot of bills come in that they're either identical with another bill that's introduced, or they're very similar. I was looking at some legislation yesterday where there's like three bills that are being introduced. I found out there were some other authors on one that I'm working on, but technically they're three different bills. So short answer of that is that are those statistics, maybe I'm asking the wrong people. They're duplicative. Okay, so their number isn't as great as what it may imply then in my interpreting that correctly.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, that's true, although there's another trend that Ms. Julek had mentioned to me earlier, which is that over time we seem to be seeing more multi-piece human services bills as well, so that whereas sometimes things would be broken up into individual proposals, more often now you're getting many, many proposals all in one single fiscal note. So, you know, those counts do duplicate proposals that might have version 1, version 2, 2A, 2B, but then there's also probably multiple pieces that aren't necessarily counted in there. So I'm giving you one that says, yep, these overstate the problem, and another issue that probably says it's understating the problem.
Thanks.
I know we're probably wanting to wrap up here, but just in the other issue moving forward to future meetings that we haven't really touched on is the fact that, yes, bonding projects don't have fiscal notes, but in many instances they should, and particularly like in the area of transportation, when you build transit systems with no way to pay for the operating subsidies. I mean, I think we really have to look at, when we do a bonding bill, what are the general fund or special revenue fund costs of this particular infrastructure and or savings. We have agencies that come to us and they want, you know, energy upgrades or technology upgrades or whatever, and they say this is a really good idea because it's going to save us costs in this way or that way, but we never book the savings anywhere to hold their feet to the fire for the investment we make in the bonding bill. So, I mean, I do think that there should be some more fiscal accounting in the realm of bonding that we just never see.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Holmer, just a couple comments on that. Bonding proposals that come through the executive branch, you know, so that would be something, not something that gets introduced as a bill and has never been through the MMB, but they should come, if there are going to be long-term operating costs or savings, those should be shown in that proposal. The problem with a fiscal note on those things is the fiscal note is only going to discuss 4 years at the most, and like this session will be 3 years, and the cost implications are usually outside of that parameter. But the bonding proposals themselves or the capital budget information should include the long-term fiscal implications of that. Just a side note on that, a few years ago, we had decided we were going to try to track all of those things as part of the tails in the operating budget. It was not a very successful effort, and it didn't work well. Just leave it at that.
Excuse the pun, but in the transportation sector, we're headed for a major train wreck here with all of these transit systems going online, declining revenues for gas tax and tab fees, and rapidly escalating subsidy costs to operate these systems, and no solution in sight. So,
well, one of the things is every time we build a new bike trail, we would be taking off all the highway maintenance costs of all the people who aren't driving cars.
Madam Chair, I think that there always are some hidden costs, and I think Representative Carlson in the discussion with GMC, and you know, one thing you learn in this process, there's no free lunch, period. Someone's going to pay. It may not be state government pay, but someone is going to pay if there's a service that we're providing or something.
I was going to say dumb, but I'll say less informed comments that the former President Bush ever made was, I thought, when cutting out some health care thing, that no one was ever going to be deprived of health care because they were always going to be able to tell you an emergency is. And once you start thinking that way, you're saying that people are getting health care at the most expensive and least effective place they possibly can get it. And this is something that, unless we're ready to say that we don't care if we see people dying on the streets or not, you know, we always have to understand this. And in terms of the unreimbursed care being $1,000 a policy, I know I had one night in an emergency room and an item on the bill, which I was only looking at academically because most of it is being paid by someone else. It was an item for $935 for miscellaneous. And I asked someone what that miscellaneous meant, and they said that's the extra amount that HCMC puts on for unrequited, unreimbursed care. So that was just one night. So, I imagine what it is for more than one night. So,
Madam Chair, just one other item that we didn't mention earlier and probably should, and I keep looking at this fiscal note that says preliminary across the top, and just wanted to mention that we don't like to use preliminary fiscal notes. What they are fiscal notes. They might be multiple agency fiscal notes where one agency has completed it and EBO has signed off on that one. So that's probably pretty good, but other agencies haven't. Or there are a one agency fiscal note and where the agency may have completed it or put a significant amount of information in, but the final step, the executive budget officer signing off, has not yet occurred. We do use them occasionally when we have a hearing, and this is the best we have, but just to point out that that's what preliminary means on there, is it's not yet and not yet completely done.
And Madam Chair, just a follow-up to, I think, in the suggestion of the role of MMB. I know that someone has to be a gatekeeper, but it looks like we got two or three gatekeepers on this role, and I want to have at least two some thoughts on the next time or can we streamline that system a little bit better to have the different agencies have maybe more authority or less authority or whatever.
Okay. Anything else before we stop? Anyone from the audience would like to say something? Thank you. Anybody have a comment? Or a question?
I bet you do.
Okay. Thank you all. Meeting adjourned.